to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Henry Ramsey, and he'll be answering your questions on matching Eastern hatches. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Henry a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill out the form on the right side of our homepage, and we'll let you know when the next live show will be. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website about 48 hours after the show ends. You can also find it on any of the podcast sites like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Casts, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website or any of the podcast platforms at your convenience and listen to the recording at any time. If you're out and about on Facebook, Instagram, or X, we'd sure appreciate it if you'd share our podcast. And when you do, use hashtag AskAboutFlyFishing and hashtag FlyFishing. In fact, if you have a moment, do it while you're watching the show. It'd be great if you let other people know about the great content we have going on here on Ask About Fly Fishing. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. When we return, we'll be talking with Henry Ramsey about matching Eastern hatches. Watermaster is dedicated to providing their customers with the highest quality inflatables on the market, as well as unbeatable customer service and product support. They are best known for their signature products, the Watermaster Grizzly, Kodiak, and Bruin rafts. These rafts are lightweight, compact, durable, versatile, and safe. The Watermaster rafts are everything your personal watercraft should be. They've been used by anglers and hunters all over the country. Visit Watermaster today and take a look at the ultimate personal flotation craft. Go to BigSkyInflatables.com. Again, that's BigSkyInflatables.com. Before we introduce Henry, we'd like to let you know about the great prizes we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International and a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at AskAboutFlyFishing.com and look for the link under tonight's section that says Register for a Free Drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Henry's book, Matching Major Eastern Hatches, courtesy of Stackpole Books. Now, here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question I ask at the end of the show, and the question will be about something that Henry and I talk about during the show. And you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely, take notes, type fast, and hopefully you'll be the proud winner of Henry's book, Matching Major Eastern Hatches. Our guest tonight is Henry Ramsey. Henry is a fly fishing writer, custom fly tire, presenter, and photographer. He is the author of Matching Major Eastern Hatches, New Patterns for Selective Trout, and co-author of Keystone Fly Fishing Guide, the Ultimate Guide to Pennsylvania's Best Water. He contributes to Fly Fisherman and Eastern Fly Fishing magazines and has appeared in a list of other books and publications. His fly fishing career began more than 50 years ago on a stream in central Pennsylvania, and his travels have taken him to many of the best streams and rivers across his home state of Pennsylvania, as well as New York, Idaho, Montana, Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, New Mexico, and other states. He conducts fly fishing classes and presents at many shows, Trout Unlimited chapters, and clubs in the eastern U.S. Henry is also a contract fly designer for Umpqua Feather Merchants, and is a member of the pro staffs for Daiichi Hooks and Regal Vices. Henry, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
All right. Thanks for having me. I'm honored to be here and looking forward to talk about fishing tonight. So thank you very much for the nice introduction.
Sure. Yeah, good to have you. And so we'll have to do my best to pick your brain tonight and share some of your knowledge with the folks listening in. So, yes, just when I was going through your bio, it just kind of struck me when you said that you started your fly fishing on a stream in central Pennsylvania. How did that start for you? What was that first time?
It was funny, Roger, and it was awkward at the same time. I had caught my first trout when I was 5 years old. Believe it or not, I released the darn thing. I don't know if it survived or not, but I released it. And I remember I was fishing with a spinning rod on a creek in central PA, and I had seen fly fishing in magazines and books, and there is a man standing in the creek, and I'm watching him cast, and it was just like watching ballet. It was beautiful. You know, it was the first time I watched somebody actually casting live. And it was not only beautiful, but he was catching fish with regularity. And I was like a bug drawn to a light. I just kept getting closer and closer, wanting to watch this spectacle. And, you know, I got too close, and it ticked the guy off, and he wound up yelling at me. And and I wound up scurrying away. I felt ashamed, you know. And my family was back out in that same neighborhood a couple weeks later, and I saw the same gentleman on the creek. And this time he came over to me and introduced himself, and it just totally blew me away. He pulled a fly box out of his vest, and in it were these neat little rows of flies that he tied with feathers from his own chickens. And I thought, my God, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. It pulled it all together for me. And so I was 11 years old, and I decided I wanted to be a fly tire. Notice I said tire, not fly angler.
Right.
I wanted to learn how to tie flies. I thought it was a beautiful connection with elements of nature, that it was something artistic. You know, I mean, I used to like to draw and paint when I was a child. And so I was naturally pulled towards something that had an art element to it. And I just love that concept of imitating nature organically with these natural materials. So I tied flies for about 3 years before I finally got a fly rod and had the courage to start fishing with the darn things, you know. So that's pretty much where this whole thing began. And now, fast forward all these years later, I'm just a bigger kid that plays in the water doing the same thing I did back then.
Yeah, that's interesting. Tying, I forget who it was. There's a guy, I think a couple other people I've interviewed over the years that started out as tires as well. And it's quite unusual. I think most people start fishing first. But yeah, that's interesting. You approached it from an artistic standpoint. And, you know, looking at the flies in your book, you're beautifully tied and you do a great job. So maybe we can pick your brain about that a little bit tonight, about things that you do in the way of tying. But we got a question in on the internet already, and so I'll hit this before we dive in. Phil in Kentucky wrote in, and he says, the smallmouth shown in your photo is a beauty. Please tell us more about catching it.
Oh, my. Every summer, I live in Pennsylvania, and we have some wonderful smallmouth fishing here. And during the summer months when trout fishing tends to take a little bit of a back seat, I generally get out with a couple friends that have drift boats or rafts, and we'll do a couple float trips through the summer. So that was on the Juniata River, which is in central PA, just northwest of Harrisburg, tributary to the Susquehanna. And it's a remarkable fishery, a beautiful river. And if the timing is right, the topwater eat can be fantastic. And what's really funny about that fish, that was the best fish of that day. And, you know, you don't put up all the pictures of the dinks that you caught throughout the day. But that fish never really broke the surface when it took that popper. It just, I saw it levitate like a submarine, and it was the most gentle take. It was like a trout taking a midge. It just sucked that popper under. And, of course, you know, everything blows up when you set the hook on them. But I absolutely love smallmouth bass fishing with a fly. That was quite a wonderful day.
Yeah, cool. Well, let's talk about some of the hatches going on. What inspired you to write Matching Major Eastern Hatches, and how does it differ from other hatch matching books that we might find for the eastern states?
It's a funny question, because I've done the whole gamut of learning to tie traditional classic flies. I was learning to tie in the early 1970s, and it was a different methodology, the way that you learned to tie back then. You learned classics, Catsco flies, and old school wets and things of that nature. And somewhere along the line, I really got triggered by the writing of later writers like Cucci and Estasi and Swisher and Richards, and some of the people that were really heavily into that match the hatch game, Ernie Schwiebert, of course. And I started coming around playing with my own patterns. I was really inspired by Vince Marinaro, and still am, and probably one of the most brilliant writers of our time. And I started going down this path of coming up with my own patterns. And a point came where I thought, my God, I can't remember what color dubbing I used for that pattern. So I started writing all these things out. And then I'm starting to do tying classes at shops and different places. And I have people saying, you know, your stuff's unique, it's different, blah, 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 blah. And I thought, no, maybe there's a story to tell. So I had been tying for probably 30 years, and I thought maybe I'm credible enough at this stage of life to start to put this thing together. So I was fortunate to meet Jay Nichols via my dear friend John Shaner, and submitted a couple chapters, and Jay was really interested in doing the work, and we spent the next year and a half putting together the stories behind these flies. My fishing is really, what excites me most about fishing is this chess match of trying mm-hmm. to interpret what's going on in the natural world with bugs and emergences and rising fish or feeding fish, and looking at a fly box as a solution to a challenge or to a problem. So I wanted to tell stories about that. How did this fly design come to fruition? What was the thought process behind it? And it was a heck of a lot of work. You know, when you work with an editor like Jay, number one, he works to bring out the best in you. He works to challenge you to develop your thoughts. And when you get a markup back, it's like being in fourth grade again with the red pencil marks all over your writing, you know. You can't talk like you're from Southeast Pennsylvania. But it was really a fascinating thing to work together to chronicle not just the patterns and the recipes behind the patterns, but the thought process and the logic behind the design.
Yeah.
It's not, I wanted to come out and say that it's not just some random haphazard thing, you know, that the stars aligned and a fly came off the vise that worked. There was a lot of thought behind that, and I wanted to express that.
Yeah, a lot of testing, too, I imagine. Many of these
flies. Yeah, I'd like to call it research, you know?
Research.
You know what I mean? You kind of put your tongue in your cheek and call it research or just fishing or whatever, but you got to go with that one, Roger. I like that.
Yeah.
Testing.
Did you do all your own photography on the book? Or did
No. That was remarkable, too, because at the time I didn't own a digital camera.
Hmm.
And so I bought a camera partway into the project and shot some of the pictures, but my dear friend Kathy Beck was really generous.
Yeah.
And what a wonderful soul and a great loss to the fly fishing community. But Kathy offered, she said, here, I'll offer you this portfolio of images. And she was really, really kind and very supportive of that process. And then all the time sequences were shot by Jay, and believe it or not, we shot all of those. It's like going into a studio to record a song. We shot all of those pictures in the course of 2 days in a hotel room in central PA, so that the backgrounds, the lighting, the focal distance, all those things would be consistent from shot to shot to shot. And and it was really quite a discipline to put that together, to play Twister with cameras and strobe lights and wires and multiple tying vices, so that you could show clearly how your hands are manipulating materials to show a step, to break it down into mechanical steps. Because I wanted a book that someone could lay out on their desk and follow with clarity. And I have to be honest with you, there's a single hardest challenge of the whole darn book was writing the captions to support each of the photographs to state what's going on. You know, it's like writing, most of us know how to ride a bike, but how would you put that into words? Begin with put your foot on this pedal at this position, So that was a bit of a challenge, but it was a heck of a lot of fun. And it was, I wanted an instructive book that was also had a little bit of an entertainment thing and had some educational thought processes behind
right.
the slides.
Yeah. Yeah, cool. Well, let's talk about, the next question is, let's talk about someone new to Eastern waters. This applies to Western waters too, or Central, but so how important is it to understand the insect life cycles compared to simply having the right fly or a fly that's working today that the guy handed you from up the river or something?
Man, that's loaded. That is a loaded question. You know, if you're going to play the hatch matching game, I mean, let's be real. A big thing today is your own netting. The flies don't look like anything found in nature. And it really is a thing of like searching drift lanes and lies in a stream bottom, trying to get a drift in front of a fish that might be in a mood to feed. A lot of the patterns don't really look like something in nature, but when that fish comes up off the stream bottom, I think it's important to kind of have a bit of an understanding about life cycles and understand how these things interplay with the natural thing of a fish trying to survive by feeding in a stream environment or a river environment. And I think we don't necessarily have to understand the taxonomy. It certainly enriches the experience, but being in a place where you're standing in a creek, having the right collection of flies in your vest or in your pack or in your fly box is really a key thing. Here in the east, the Hendrickson is probably one of my favorite fly hatches, but it's only here for a narrow window of the year. So understanding when to expect them, what kinds of environments you might find them in, understanding what the different stages of that hatch life cycle look like can definitely put you in a better situation to be successful when those trout are looking up and looking at things in the drift as opposed to things that are tumbling along the bottom of the stream bed.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about, since we're, I mean, there's multiple species insects here that are on the East Coast, but maybe we can kind of, we don't have time to talk about all of them tonight, but maybe we can kind of talk about the six most important. And so what do you consider like the six most important insect groups?
Six. I would have to say
four.
Ooh, wow. Yeah, it's kind of tough to winnow that down to a short list. But, you know, the thing to really be aware of is here in the east, a lot of our waters at some point in time in history were compromised, either by industry, by agriculture, by resource extraction for quite a long time. Acid rain, acid drainage has affected a lot of our streams in a dramatic manner. A lot of streams are in varying stages of recovery from prior exploitation and resource extraction. So one of the things that jumps out to me is caddisflies, because they're more tolerant of point source pollution. So we're going to encounter them on all of our waters, compromised or uncompromised waters. So it makes them terribly important. And if there was one caddisfly that stands out amongst all of those, it would be the speckled sedge, the hydrocyte species caddis, because they're definitely the most widely distributed, not only here in the east, but across the country. So I would have to put that one at number one, just because of probability and the really extended emergence that's measured in months rather than weeks or days, like the green drake, for instance.
Right.
Yeah, number two, I would probably have to say the sulfur, because when you look at streams here in the east, and I'll pick on the Juniata River, or the Little Juniata River, I'll pick on the Lackawanna River, two streams that were severely compromised by point source pollution for decades. And, you know, as these streams have cleansed themselves, have, you know, upgraded sewage treatment facilities and things of that nature, one of the first mayflies to repopulate a stream are the ones we categorically refer to as sulfurs. So we find those in streams that are uncompromised as well as ones that are heavily compromised. Those would definitely rank as the big two. Going beyond that, March Brown's pretty widely distributed mayfly, very common. Brings a lot of big fish up to the top. They seem to thrive rather well in a lot of different streams, even ones that have been slightly compromised by industry or agriculture. Cahills would be another one that would fall into that bucket. Very adaptable, very common. I was doing some research for a new presentation I'm going to premiere in a couple weeks at Mainline Fly Tires. And, you know, when you look at the bugs that we call Cahills, so there's better than two dozen species in Stenonema, Stenochron, and Macafertium that we would all call a Cahill if we caught one in our hand along the creek. So we're at four, right?
Yeah.
Midges can play a key role at certain times of the year, even on streams that have been heavily compromised. Chironomids are pretty adaptive to mild pollution, don't require as much dissolved oxygen as some of the more sensitive species. And the last one is not even a bug. I mean, an aquatic insect, ants.
Ants.
They're everywhere. They're on nearly every continent of the world. They play such a key role throughout the year. And if you want to see evidence of that, be on the water when there's a flying ant hatch. Because trout get single-minded like teenagers. And if you don't have a flying ant pattern in your box, you might as well just tuck your rod under your arm and enjoy the show. Because trout really key on hard on ants. And I carry ants all year round.
You know, you're not the first person that's mentioned ants, but I don't see people fishing with them a lot. I think it's kind of a underrated insect.
Not in Pennsylvania, Roger.
Yeah, everybody sees it up there.
Not in PA, because I know there's people on here from all over the place. But when you look at it, most of the really great ant patterns, they were born here in Pennsylvania. When you're going back to Bob McCafferty with the hard shell wet ant, it's a wet fly with lacquered segments and a soft tackle. I still fish this all the time. It's a remarkable fly. Marinero, you look at the McMurray ant. Tommy Baltz ties a fantastic parachute ant pattern. A lot of the great ant patterns found their birth here in PA. Marinero and Fox talked at them about the importance of ants at length. So we take them pretty serious here in PA. If you look at matching, I talk about all these different color variants, red-headed ants, cinnamon ants, black ants, carpenter ants. Some of us tie them bright fire engine red, and they all have a place. And there's never a bad day to fish an ant. And even, I don't know if you remember Ken Miata, he used to write for Fly Fisherman Mag. He did an article back in the 1980s about anting the hatch.
Anting the hatch.
He wrote a really brilliant piece on that. And that inspired me when I was a younger guy. And I still listen to that. And I've done my own experiments fishing trico spinnerfalls and just fishing ants during a trico spinnerfall. And something completely different from those tens of thousands of spinners on the surface. And those trout will take that ant without hesitation, even when they're looking at a patterned target image of tens of thousands of cookie-cutter bugs in the film.
Yeah.
They'll take that ant.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Well, we need to take a quick break here, Henry. We'll be right back, and we'll dive deeper into the eastern hatches of United States here. So hang tight. We'll be right back. The Ugly Bug Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming has been serving fly fishers in Wyoming and around the world since 1983. Their selection of top-of-the-line gear and a huge assortment of flies is one of the best in the land. All products are available in their fly shop and online. Looking for advice? Just give them a call and their expert professional staff will help you with whatever you need. Visit the Ugly Bug Fly Shop today at uglybugflyshop.com or call them at 866-845-9284. Again, that's the uglybugflyshop.com or call them at 866-845-9284. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Henry Ramsey about matching Eastern hatches. If you'd like to ask Henry a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Henry, I always ask my guests what's going on in your fly fishing world, and so tell us, what are you up to nowadays?
Ooh, well, if you live in Pennsylvania, we've had the worst of summers. I think it began sometime in early June where it seemed like it either rained or it was 100 degrees or both, nonstop. So it really, I had fished pretty extensively. I really, really love the early stoneflies. One of my first hatches. You know, it's cold, it's nasty, but it's fun. It was a lot of fun this year. I did a trip out to Utah, camped along the Green River, spent a couple days float fishing there, spent some time fishing the Provo. Unbelievable Betis olive fishing out there. Just so cool to watch 18, 20-inch, 21-inch fish coming up, feeding on size 18 and 20 Betis olives in the middle of the day. We had a wonderful time with that. I got to catch my first Bonneville cutthroat on a little mountain stream in Utah, wading through about a foot of snow, which was a remarkable experience. Did some really good fishing in northern and central Pennsylvania. Packed up a wet tent more times than I really like to pack up a wet tent. But really good fishing there. Got to spend some time up in the Catskills, exploring some new waters up there. And then the heat and the rain, it's nonstop, just seemed to put things on hold for a while. Some smallmouth fishing in the month of August. And right now, I'm in the process of finalizing a new presentation. Like I said earlier, I'm going to roll out for the first time at a mainline fly tires down in the Philadelphia, PA area. Later this month, I've got a presentation at my home team chapter. Getting ready in between all of that for a trip to Idaho in a few weeks. Be going out and camping on the St. Joe River up in the Panhandle. I think this will be my third time doing that trip. So there's a lot of stuff. Building a presentation is pretty labor-intensive, especially from a photography standpoint. To not only get the bugs, but the fly patterns. I like to not just talk about taxonomy and show pictures of insects, but I like to do a segment I call What's in My Fly Box, where I talk about the patterns that I rely on for all the different hatches that I cover in the program. I was just shooting some images earlier tonight to make that visually appealing for my audience. So, it's exciting. When I come back from Idaho, I'm looking forward to doing at least one or two more camping trips up to northern PA. I really, really love fishing for native brook trout up in the mountains. I have my little one-man tent, a really simple camping setup, and I go back in the middle of nowhere and live like a caveman for 3 or 4 days and drive home and shave and get dressed up and go back to the office. So a lot of good things to look forward to. Whiskey and wood smoke. Whiskey and wood smoke. There'll be a lot of that coming up in October.
Yeah, cool. Well, good. Sounds like you've been busy and going to be busy. So, good luck with your next presentation there. Sounds like a winner. Okay. You've got Tucker McElroy in Chicago wrote in. He says, do you think that more emphasis should be placed on fly fishermen being able to identify nymph and pupa stages of mayflies and caddisflies? And then he just comments, besides knowing the general type, clinger, swimmer, crawler, burrower, it would be worth it to fly fishermen if they could pick up a rock. They would not only know the type, but what the adult would be. So what are your thoughts on identifying all those stages? We talked about life cycle like a little bit, but.
Tucker's a man after my heart. Because if you ever come to one of my presentations, it's something that I talk about. You think about this thing. Let's take the beginning of the month of May, the start of the holy season. If you go into a healthy trout stream and pick up a stone, it's covered with bugs. So how do you know which bugs are relevant at the time? And I try to show in my photographs how to determine what's a mature versus an immature larva. And the whole key is looking at wing cases, whether it's a stonefly or a caddisfly or a mayfly. When those wing cases turn black, things are getting ready to happen. And those are the bugs that you really should be starting to think about. When I'm going to fish a nymph, and what's going to be starting to pop tonight or in the middle of the day, what bugs are going to be hatching? It's going to be those larval forms that are getting blackened wing cases, ones that are more blended in with the rest of the body color or not ready to pop yet. So, yeah, that's a great question, Tucker. When you
you're talking about, Henry, you're talking about being able to predict the next stage then and be ready for that, because rather than wait for it to happen and then react, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So that's a great thing. And really, it's an interesting thing to be able to pick up a rock and be able to isolate and understand that the crawlers are usually going to be Hendricksons or sulfurs, something to that effect. The flattened crawlers are usually either going to be Cool Gordon, Marsh Brown, something that we would call a Cahill later on. So understanding, making that correlation is really worthwhile. When I go to a new stream, I want to learn that water. So, I am one of those geek kind of guys that leans his rod up against a tree and picks up some stones to see what's going on there. And it's really cool to be able to see that. And I can tell you, like for Keystone fly fishing was a great example of that, because I had to go back and revisit streams that I'd fished in my youth. Some of those streams were really heavily compromised by point source pollution from paper mills and things of that nature, agriculture. And, to flip over a rock and say, wow, this creek is on the mend, to see the diversity of bug life that didn't exist there, when I was a younger guy, is a remarkable thing. And to be able to say, yeah, that's a Marsh Brown nymph, that's a sulfur nymph, that's a golden stonefly nymph, it definitely enriches the experience. And like I said earlier, you can really help set up your success being able to better predict what's going to happen that day or within the next couple of days on a creek.
Yeah. Question from Jason Stacy in Kentucky. He says, when matching a hatch, do you prefer a fly that is a direct match or more of a general look fly?
Yeah, that's the funny question. I really appreciate the question, Jason. When you look at my patterns, one of the things that is kind of a funny note for me, I grew up learning to tie, studying people like Paul Jorgensen and Chauncey Lively, who were remarkable tiers, and they were going down this path of paring feathers, burning feathers, or cutting feathers to shape to create these defined wing on mayfly patterns, for instance. So I went down that rabbit hole as well. The flies were cool. They were beautiful. They worked. They didn't always fish that well. They didn't cast well, worth a darn. But along comes CDC. And I'm looking at this material, and it creates this really vague thing. So when you look at my patterns, you see that I try to match the body colors, the tails, the legs, and that thing with the hackle. But then I throw in this shapeless thing in the form of CDC feathers, because CDC moves. It's a neat materials. I would like to say, Jason, that my patterns are kind of like a mix, if that makes sense, because there's elements that are really a close match, but then other things that are more vague in nature. You certainly don't need to go down that path of making flies that are exact imitations, but it's a cool thing. I just enjoy the heck out of that. And maybe that's just the tired geek in me, more so than the angler geek. Maybe that's the way that that manifests itself. Yeah, but I get it. Okay. The whole thing of impressionism is a cool perspective. I like to go a little bit more specific than impressionistic.
We've got a couple questions that came in here on the internet. Dan Canale in Rockwood, Ontario says, are comparidons the same as haystacks?
No, they're not. The original haystack was the inspiration for the comparidon. So, I mean, they're very close to one another. One, the comparidon was inspired by the haystack. And Fran Betters was a fascinating man. Yeah, he had some pretty cool thoughts on tying flies that would float well in the Aux-Sable River. He tied a fly that floated, was highly impressionistic, and Coochie and Estazi took that to a higher degree, making it more customized with colors to imitate different species, whereas Fran basically tied one iteration, as far as I'm aware, a more nondescript pattern called the haystack.
Yeah, okay. Another question from Phil in Kentucky again. He says, how important do you find understanding insect hatches when going after smallmouth instead of trout? Is it understanding the role of minnows in the watershed is as important as the role of insects?
No, and it's funny. I don't know if my friend Brian Shoemaker's on here or not. Brian's a smallmouth guide in central PA. And Brian will tell you that, in his opinion, smallmouth bass are more intelligent than trout. So him and I have good gentlemanly disagreements about that. You know, smallmouth bass are funny. I've never found them. They can be fickle. They can be particular. But I find that they can be more particular about presentation more than they are about pattern. Like, I love to fish the topwater game for bass. It's visual. It's a cool thing to watch the reaction to the fly and the presentation of the fly. But there's a time to make noise, and there's a time to let that fly be quiet. I can tell you on the last trip that I did, if that fish didn't hit a popper within the first 2 to 3 strips of the fly, they were never going to take it. It was like a reactive kind of thing. But I've never found smallmouth to be selective to an imitation of a particular minnow or a particular bug. I know there's days that one color may tend to fish better than another color. On that, the last two trips that I did, chartreuse of blue were the two colors. There's other times that I go out that they definitely want a white fly or they want a black fly. But I've never found them to be selected toward a particular bait fish.
Okay.
Or a particular insect. Not my experience.
All right. Another break here, Henry. We'll be right back.
Okay.
Discover the power of Pierce Skagit with Olympic Peninsula Skagit Tactics. From delicate soft tackles to hefty steelhead flies, OPST's versatile casting system meets the demands of every angling situation. With Ed Ward's unparalleled Skagit rod design and casting expertise, OPST offers you a quicker route to mastering effective casting techniques. Whether battling wind and rain or targeting steelhead trout or smallmouth bass, trust OPST's innovative rods, lines, and tips to elevate your fishing experience. Join the ranks of skilled anglers who rely on OPST for consistency, proficiency, and a superior fly fishing adventure. Unleash your potential with OPST today. Visit PierceSkagit.com. Or call them at 206-858-8476. Again, that's PierceSkagit.com. And you can call them at 206-858-8476. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Henry Ramsey about matching Eastern hatches. If you'd like to ask Henry a question, just go to our homepage, fill out that form, and send it in. We'll try to get it answered tonight on the show. Okay, Henry, let's talk about mayflies. Oh, let's see. Okay, this is a follow-up question from that Dan Canale. He says, Henry referred to a flattened crawler nymph. Did he mean a clinger nymph?
Yeah, I meant a clinger.
Okay, all right. Okay, so there you go, man.
When I said flattened, I apologize. I meant to say, you know, a clinger nymph. You know,
okay.
Cool Gordon,
okay.
March Brown, Cahill.
Okay, good. So mayflies, poster child of hatch matching. Can you kind of walk us through the major mayfly species anglers should know of on the eastern coast?
Okay. Here in the east, the mayfly season usually kicks off with the little Betis olives. And it's a late winter, early spring proposition. Cold water, so usually the middle of the day, a small olive-colored mayfly, usually a size 18. There'll be a fall brood that's a successive generation of the same species in the fall. We have some streams where we can find Betis olives, you know, three different emergences throughout the year. So a very important bug. Sticking within the early season, Cool Gordons on some of our streams that really have great water quality, they can be an important bug. The little blue quill is one of my favorite early season emergences. A little mahogany-colored mayfly, usually a size. I always wish that we had like a true size 17 hook, because they're like in between a 16 and an 18, so I usually err with an 18 unless the water's a little bit heavier and I'll fish with a bigger fly. Probably my favorite early season hatch would be the Hendrickson. Beautiful bugs. They enjoy a pretty good distribution. They really start to bring a lot of nice fish are starting to look up about the time that the Hendricksons come on. The Hendrickson spinnerfalls can really be intense fishing. There's usually just this little bit of a lull between Hendricksons and then the March Brown. And the March Brown is really starts to get bigger fish looking top, looking up. And I can tell you with confidence that some of the best fish of the year for me are during the March Brown. The sulfurs are usually starting to hatch around the same time. We've got a number of different species that we collectively refer to as sulfurs. And like I said earlier, they're really widely distributed, more so than many other insects that are more environmentally sensitive. Cahills will start to show. If you're fishing up in the Pocono area of Pennsylvania, up into the Catskills, the big Cornuta olives can be some really exciting fishing. Isonychias, the slate drake, whatever you want to call them, and of course the green drake. Everybody gets excited and dreams about the green drake.
Yeah.
And if you're on the water, you know, and it's a spectacle.
It is.
And I'm always amazed that during the green drake, it's everything in nature is there. The ducks, the crows, the mergansers, everybody's there at the water's edge to feed on those darn green drakes. Everything comes to the water, and a lot of anglers. So those would be the big ones.
Okay.
There's a lot of lesser. The brown drake can be a wonderful experience if you're on streams that have populations like Kettle Creek, the Cinnamahoning, the Allegheny River, and then trichos. And there was a time that I would be on the water a couple mornings a week at daybreak for the tricho hatch. I haven't admittedly put as much energy into that in recent years, but yeah, I've done quite a bit of tricho fishing over the years. So that's pretty much the biggies. There's a lot of lesser bugs that can play an important role here and there, but I've just taken the skim at the top.
Okay, we've got a couple questions on emergers here. So maybe I'll just combine a couple questions here. How do you tell when trout are feeding on the emergers, and what's your approach to fishing the hatch when trout are selectively eating emergers?
That's a great question. It's a super techie question, too, which I love. In my personal opinion, there's no discernible difference in the rise form between a trout that's eating emergers, taking upright wing duns. There's not like a visual key in, say, the rise form. Spinner rise form is remarkably different than a trout that's feeding on duns or emergers, but duns and emergers look the same. It's really about observation. But a thing that I think bears importance is understanding the bugs themselves. There's some hatches where an emerger pattern really isn't as important as it is with others, but an observation of mine is that there are certain species that have more of a challenge with hatching. And some of that can be environmentally induced, like betta solids. They're hatching in cold weather. Sometimes it's snowing. Sometimes it's raining. Sometimes it's very cold. And so this slows down the process. It slows down that emergence process, that things don't happen rapidly. Cahills hatch very quickly. March browns can hatch very quickly, but those little betta solids really seem to struggle because of the temperature and the weather conditions. So when I'm fishing the betta solid hatch, 9 times out of 10, I'm going to start with an emerger pattern. And if that doesn't pay off, I might switch to a thorax dun, for instance. And the other hatches where I see that same kind of challenge would be anything ephemerella. So think about Hendrickson's, think about sulfurs, think about PMDs in the West. I really have no clue as to the why. I wish I understood that more and could convey that. But those three species seem to have more struggles than other species during emergence. So there seems, in my opinion and observation, to be more casualties. So we talk about stillborns, we talk about stuck in the shuck kinds of things. I have a collection of images that I've shot of Hendrickson's that were stuck in the shuck or crippled flies. And I really don't understand why. I've also photographed a lot of ephemerella nymphs where you could see some kind of a defect in the larva that more than likely impacted their ability to have a successful emergence, fly away and fall in love. So there's certain hatches where I know instinctively my first reaction is going to be to put on an emerger pattern rather than a dun. So I don't know if that's helpful or not. I wish I had some kind of empirical, you know, knowledge statistics to wow the heck out of people with. But I can tell you that certain bugs have more challenges than others. And I generally just start my fishing with an emerger pattern right off the bat.
Would you ever fish a cripple with an emerger at the same time?
I have this pattern I came up with years ago, and I call it a DOA cripple. And it's basically a dun pattern tied on a curved shank hook with more of a down wing. It has a trailing shuck on it, so it combines those elements of a partially emerged insect. I have another emerger pattern. The DOA wasn't in matching. If we ever do a revision, I definitely want to do a chapter on the DOA cripple because it's a money fly for me and a lot of my friends and customers that buy them. The other one would be my half and half, which is just as it says, it's a pattern that's kind of like a freeze frame of a partially emerged mayfly. And during those sulfur PMD Hendrickson hatches, that's usually one of the first patterns I tie on, that or the DOA cripple. And so I try to make the patterns imitate that partially emerged thing or that bug that's kind of been beat up in the process. We were doing this with video content, I could show you and explain it a little bit better.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Gary Kaufman wrote in and says, and he's from North Carolina. He says, regarding multiple flies, what condition determine the setup that you use? And do you use multiple flies?
I don't use multiple flies from the perspective of multiple species. So this is a beautiful question. I always tell people, you can blow whatever you want to blow on a fly rod. And I'm as guilty as many of spending a lot of money on a really good fly rod and a nice reel to attach to the darn thing. But the best thing is what God gave you is your eyes. Spending time watching. Fish some of the more technical waters. When I think of streams like the Henry's Fork, which I absolutely love to fish, the West Branch, East Branch of the Delaware, you know, some of these Penns Creek, you know, these places are bug factories. And it's not an uncommon thing to have three or four bugs hatching concurrently. And you're stuck with this really cool thing of saying, which bug? So I always tell people, just stop casting. Just take 5 minutes and stop casting. And you may have to do this on each fish that you target, but stop and just watch that fish and look at the rise form. So I'm talking about focusing rather than just scattergun, putting a fly all over a pool, hoping for a victim. If you ever went hunting for geese, you know, you target one goose in the flock and not the flock when you pull the trigger.
Right. Yeah.
So I do the same thing when I fish a technical stream with multiple hatches. I'm looking at a fish, studying that fish, studying its rise form, and what does it take? Is it chasing a swim-up pupa and ignoring those green drakes? That happens all the time on Penns Creek. Is it a casual sipping kind of thing? What's going on with the rise form of that particular fish? And then trying to winnow that down. Now, one thing that I'll often do is fish dry dropper. During a March brown, a sulfur, I might have a thorax done and a foot or a foot and a half of tippet and a nymph pattern or a soft tackle. So I'm trying to cover multiple stages of a given bug. You know, and it's that thing of, you know, it's like a murder scene. You have to use some process of elimination, but it starts with just stop casting for a few minutes and watch. Just look. And you might see a clue. You might see a bubble in the rise that tells you something. It may be something in the rise form. You might actually watch a bug disappear into a fish's mouth. And when you crack that code, man, there's not a better feeling. If you've been working a fish and getting worked over by that fish, and you finally crack that code, oh, my God, that's fantastic. That's the stuff that I spend all winter dreaming about. And I know I'm not the only person on this call that has had that same experience when it all comes together.
Yeah. Let's talk about caddisflies here for a few minutes.
Okay.
Caddisflies often confuse anglers compared to mayflies. What key differences should we focus on when we're into a caddisfly hatch as opposed to mayflies?
This is beautiful because I was reading the questions in advance of tonight's call, and it's really interesting. A story came to mind fishing October caddis on the St. Joe River in Idaho a few years ago. Three of us fishing together, a pool with rising fish everywhere. And when we're fishing together as a group like that, we play this game of taking turns. One guy gets to fish for a little while, and then we go through a rotation. And we were all kind of getting schooled by these fish, and rises everywhere. They're not eating dry flies. You can tell they're eating October caddis. It was the only bug on the water. And so it's this thing of, like, trying all these different October caddis patterns and nothing. And then it was funny. I was being a smart aleck, and I said to my buddies, I said, you know, guys, you just have to kind of conjure. You have to conjure a take. And I had a really big partridge in orange soft tackle in my box and went to the top of the pool instead of working from the bottom or the middle and started swinging this thing and caught a fish right off the bat. So, of course, I said, see that, guys? It's all powers of observation, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, okay, let's see you do it again. And I did, and I caught another fish on the next cast, and that was it. One of the real challenges in a caddis emergence is really understanding, are they taking adults or are they taking swim-up pupa? Because the rises can look very, very similar, but they're really not when you stop and you watch. You don't see an air bubble. You don't see a fish's head break the surface. A lot of times it's their tail that breaks the surface. They're following a swim-up pupa, and pupa swim unbelievably fast. If you want proof, try to photograph one in a dish of water. They're scooting around like a motorboat. So they'll chase a pupa up, and they'll take it and turn. And sometimes when they break water, it's their dorsal fin, it's their tail, it's their back, and not their mouth. So a caddis hatch has that challenge that's always there. And I have to tell you, I think in the last 5-6 years or more, I've really changed gears on my caddis fishing, and I'm fishing old school North Country spiders most of the time with amazing success. The flies, the way that you fish them, duplicates the illusion of a pupa swimming to the surface to pop. You know, oftentimes they're taking it right at the end of the swing when the fly is moving up through the water column to the surface. And it's electric. It's fun. And the flies are beautiful and fun to tie. I still carry adult patterns and fish them extensively. But my default during caddis is to fish a soft tackle to imitate a swim-up pupa.
Interesting. Yeah, yeah. What materials, you know, when you're talking about soft tackle and so forth, what materials do you like to use to create more lifelike imitation, lifelike action? Do you like CDC? Are there other materials you like?
When I'm tying soft tackles, I really kind of try to pay homage to those old tires from the 1700s and 1800s. So I really enjoy using those materials. It's a bit of tribute in that. But those materials themselves are quite wonderful. I use a lot of partridge, obviously. Woodcock, coot has a big place in a lot of my soft tackle patterns. Starling, of course. But there's some other things that are wonderful. A bobwhite quail is a heck of a lot cheaper than snipe and makes a pretty good imitation. Some of the different kinds of grouse, Gamble's quail, California quail. I kind of like those more so than hen hackle. And I'll probably tick off my people in the hackle industry. I think they've ruined hen hackles. They're not soft and webby anymore. They're like the rooster hackles that I was tying with when I was 10, 11 years old. They're glossy and don't have as much web. So I really like land-based birds, game birds more than anything else. I use chukar partridge a lot. And, of course, silk thread is just such a cool medium to work with. I use a lot of natural dubbings, use a touch dubbing technique to keep the dubbing really sparse so that you have that mixture of the silk color with the dubbing when it gets wet. I kind of really enjoy the alchemy of those kinds of patterns and pretty much stick with tradition. I don't do a lot of things like intermingling synthetics or beads or CDC, you know, with soft tackle patterns.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. We're running short on time here, so let's talk about stoneflies. Now, first of all, that's something that's often overlooked in the East compared to the West. I know, you know, out here, I mean, I'm in Colorado and stoneflies are a big thing out here. So what about Eastern streams?
This is a great question. I love this. We've got a lot of stoneflies out here, and they're important in different ways. We have the same Pteranarces stoneflies here in the East that you have in the West. It's a different species that are collectively known as golden stones. We have those. The challenge is that they don't present themselves in emergence density like you find on the Madison River with salmon flies, Pteranarces stoneflies. But here in the East, You can never go wrong fishing a nymph imitation of any of those big stoneflies. And there's times where I do a little change-up pitch, and I'll fish like a big chubby Chernobyl with a dropper nymph underneath it and some faster water and ones that look like a golden stonefly. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't work, but I play that once in a while. But the stoneflies that I really find to be important here in the East would be the early blacks and early brown stoneflies. The main thing here in the East is that, you know, it's a closed season hatch. A lot of the streams that are stocked, you're not allowed to fish them during those months. But on the open streams that are unstocked, early black, early brown stoneflies can be absolutely electric. The fishing is phenomenal. It's cold. You know, it challenges me. I might fish an hour before my feet are numb, and I'm back in the car warming up, and I'm back out then for a half an hour before my feet get numb. But I'll do that pretty religiously starting late January, right in the middle of the day when the water is the warmest. And the other one that really is one of my favorite hatches among all is the Yellow Sally. And what's remarkable here in our mountain streams across northern Pennsylvania, they'll often start in late May, early June. They'll hatch in profusion just before dark, and it can be absolutely electric. And the other thing is that trout never seem to get selective towards the Yellow Sally, and even when we don't have those flies emerging in the evening, you can always find egg-laying flies, mating flies that drop onto the water, fall into the water at any time during the day. And you can't go wrong fishing a Yellow Sally as a search pattern any time of the day from May through the summer months if you're fishing in the mountain streams, northern PA, the Catskills. And in fact, my very first original pattern was my Yellow Sally that I wrote a chapter on in Matching. We later did a piece in Fly Fisherman Mag on that, and that pattern goes back to 1983, remains unchanged, and I fish those things religiously. So stoneflies are important here in the East, maybe not the same species that we fish in the West, but the smaller stoneflies can be really relevant, and a big golden stone or a black stonefly nymph is never, ever a bad choice if you nymph fish.
Are there any common mistakes you see anglers make when fishing a stonefly hatch or things that you do a bit differently than maybe others?
Mistakes in a stonefly hatch. Being unprepared. It's almost a pity in a way. You know, mayflies and caddisflies get all the glory. And a stonefly hatch here in the East is really not was high on everybody's radar, so they get to the stream and they're unprepared. I've shared a stream with friends, and all of a sudden we have a blizzard of isoperla Yellow Sallies coming off, and nobody has a fly. I got a box of them, and I'm everybody's best friend in that moment. And so that would be the big thing, is being unprepared. And the other thing, too, and this is interesting, when you look at an early black stonefly, they're black, hence the name, right? And I see a lot of people tie that in a manner that imitates that fly at rest and imitates it by tying an all-black fly, which sounds great, right? Cast that thing 25 feet and try to see it on the water. You can't see a black fly, and you cast it 25 feet out unless the light's just perfect. And the other thing that's really important, Roger, is that when you watch those early stoneflies on the water, they're never at rest. They're having a heck of a time getting off the water, so they're fluttering and skittering and moving. So I purposely tie mine kind of like a delta wing type thing, that I can skitter it. I can add some movement to the fly and trigger a strike and use a lighter colored material for the wings so that I can see the darn thing. I cast it 25 or 35 feet. So that's a big mistake, is that thing of being unprepared or tying a fly that looks like a fly at rest when those flies are never restful.
Never restful. Okay, great, great, good tips. Midges. What situations make midge imitations indispensable on eastern waters?
That's a great question. I do fish midges. I don't fish them as much as I could, but I can tell you in the colder months, chironomids play a huge role. We don't have a lot of bugs coming off as far as mayflies, and we don't have caddisflies that are coming off in cold weather, but chironomids will hatch on a 40-degree afternoon in January. It may only be an hour, 45 minutes, but it can sometimes be profuse enough to get fish starting to come up and sip midges on the surface. So I'll play that game when I get tired of looking out and sitting in the house and tying flies and dreaming about fishing. I don't do it as much as I could. But another method, another time for me beyond the cold weather, sometimes in the summer months, like right after our tricho spinner falls are done for the morning, it will often be followed by some midge activity, some caddis activity. So I'll spend another hour or so on a stream, oftentimes dropping a midge pupa under an adult caddis fly. And I tag a lot of fish with that method as well. Some of our streams that are really heavily pressured sometimes force fish to adapt to feeding behaviors that are more protective. So I'll pick on the Little Lehigh up in the Allentown, Bethlehem area. It's a stream that flows right through an urban greenway, the middle of the city. And a lot of people fish the Little Lehigh, rightly so. It's a great stream, has a lot of historic value, Jim Leisingring and others. And those trout will focus on the tiniest things under the sun in the name of protecting themselves from anglers. So you can get into a lot of neat fun, fishing technical, midge pupa patterns, midge larva patterns. If you like fishing size 24, 26 on 7X, 8X,
yeah,
it's like running a vacuum cleaner. I do it when I have to. It's not something I go out of my
preferred,
way to
do.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Good question.
Okay. Yeah. One last one here for you. How do you adjust your fly selection when conditions are tough and trout are ignoring the traditional hatch patterns?
Can you repeat that, please?
Yeah. How do you adjust your fly selection when conditions are tough and trout are ignoring the traditional hatch patterns?
Ooh, that's a really interesting question. There's some hatches that I fish on more technical waters where I might carry a wider assortment of sizes, being a really big thing. A lot of times a fish will refuse a 16 but take an 18. So being aware of that and having a range of fly sizes can be one thing. And then looking at some of the hatches, like the sulfur and the beta solid, for instance, I carry a huge array of sizes, colors, and shapes. And the sulfurs can range in color from really pastel yellow to a rusty orange color, can be present in sizes from 14 to 20, can have both duns, cripples, emergers on the surface at the same time. So in some of those cases, I carry a pretty wide range. When I fish PMDs out west, I have a box of nothing but PMD patterns in all different shapes and sizes. And then the thing in there is don't be afraid to throw a changeup pitch in there. I mean, baseball pitchers have it nailed down. You just don't throw a fastball every time at somebody. Sometimes you have to throw a knuckleball and just kind of, that might be what it takes to strike out a batter or get a fish in the net. So never overlook having an ant or two in your fly boxes.
Yeah.
When they're really being snotty, throw him a curveball, throw him an ant.
Yeah. Otherwise, what you're saying is basically you try to come prepared with a lot of the options for the hatch at hand and try to work that hatch as much as possible and try to dial it in.
Yeah.
And then if it's just not happening, then go to the ant, which is or a beetle. Right?
A beetle, yeah. Yeah, I was just thinking that after I stopped talking. At the end of the day, it's ask yourself why you're doing this. And we don't call it catching. We call it fishing, right?
Right.
And right. Some days we get schooled and we go home and it's like you're cursing under your breath and you sit down and you take a fly pattern and you make a little minor revision to it. And you go out the next day and it works.
Yeah.
So that's what this thing is all about. It's the learning, the relearning, that challenge. And understand, we're not going to catch every fish. And you know what? I don't think it's healthy to catch every fish. Fly fishing should be something that's always at arm's length or just out of your reach. It should be challenging.
Sure, a little challenge. Yeah, should be challenging. Yeah, that's why we do it. So,
amen.
Yeah, if you caught a fish on every cast, it would get boring real quick.
I'd take up golf or pickleball or something else.
Yeah, golf is maybe a close second to being challenging. I'm not a golfer, but it seems like... there's some funny comedy routines that are out there about golf. But anyways, trying to hit that little ball all those yards down to get it one single little hole, you know? So sometimes fly fishing seems easier, but I don't know. I'm not a golfer. Anyway, we've run out of time, but when we return, we're going to give away a few prizes, a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International, a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited, and we're also giving away one of Henry's books, Matching Major Eastern Hatches, courtesy of Stackpole Books. And we have that right on our website, a link to that book if you want to. If you don't win, and you should go get a copy of it if you're fishing on the East and want some exciting, well-designed patterns, check out Henry's book. So hang tight, and we'll give those away in just a moment. The Bonefish and Tarpon Trust works very hard to safeguard the future of our beloved flats fisheries from protecting spawning sites like threatened by unsustainable fishing pressure to securing historic funding to restore Florida's Everglades and estuaries. Thanks to their members, they've expanded their conservation to the Bahamas, Belize, and Mexico. There's still much more work to be done, and they need your help. With your support, they can ensure that the flats fishery is healthy and sustainable now and for generations to come. Visit btt.org and become a member of the Bonefish and Tarpon Trust today. Again, that's btt.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes. The winners for our drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for our next show so you don't miss out on a chance to win one of these prizes. Okay, so the first thing we're giving away is, and if you are one of the lucky winners, we'll contact you after the show to collect your information so that we can deliver the prize to you. So first, we're giving away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International. And to learn more about FFI, go to flyfishersinternational.org, flyfishersinternational.org. So now, let's see, our winner for that is Gary Kaufman. Gary Kaufman in North Carolina. I believe Gary asked a question tonight, so congrats, Gary. I'm sure you'd be happy to enjoy your membership to FFI. And now, 1 year membership to Trout Unlimited. Learn more about Trout Unlimited, go to tu.org, and both these organizations, if you don't win tonight, go support them. They help all of us with our fly fishing efforts and conservation. Our winner for that is, let me see here, it is Joshua Fair. Joshua Fair, or Farrar, in Pennsylvania. Oh, a neighbor of yours there, Henry.
A former co-worker of mine.
Oh, he is?
Yeah.
Okay, awesome. Okay, well, congrats to Joshua, and he now has a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. And now we'll give away, let me clear my queue here, make sure there's no more questions hanging out there. Okay, one last question here. I'll throw it in because I missed it. Dan Canelli, how important is the mayfly spinner falls to the trout angler?
Oh my gosh. Critical.
Keep it short.
critical. I mean, spinners are amazing. You think about this, most of our spinner fall, I should say most, many of our spinners fall on the water just before dark. And it's a magic hour because it, oftentimes a lot of really good-sized fish come up. They have a predictable stream of food coming at them. And what's more important than anything else is most of the predators that come after trout are on the roost. You know, the eagles, mm-hmm. the osprey, the kingfishers are no longer flying up and down the creek. So it's a safe witching hour. And I can tell you, I have caught so many big fish on spinners just before dark. I mean, I wish I had time to share some of those stories, but spinners are critical and so often overlooked by anglers that they're huge. And the beauty is that a lot of bugs will fall into a couple different colors when they mold into spinners. So a rusty spinner, if you're only going to carry one, man, carry a rusty spinner in a bunch of sizes from 12 down to 20, and you can't go wrong with that. They're just, they're tough to see. And a lot of anglers overlook them because they're busy casting and not watching the water.
Yeah. Good. Well, a little closing tip there for you folks. Thanks to Henry. Well, let's give away Henry's book, Matching Major Eastern Hatches, courtesy of Stackpole Books. So I'm going to ask a question. The first person to answer it correctly, using that text box on our homepage, put in your name, your location, and your answer, and you'll win Henry's book, Matching Major Eastern Hatches. Okay, Henry mentioned his favorite early season hatch. Which mayfly is that? Early season hatch with his favorite early season hatch. So Henry takes a few seconds for them to hear that because there's a slight delay. And then they have to type and then we get their answer. So we'll hang tight here while and keep pressing the refresh button until we get an answer. Come on here. Come on. Somebody's got to know it. Oh, I think the first person that got it, let's see here. Yeah, Stephen Sykes wrote in Hendrickson.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner.
There you go, Stephen. Okay, congratulations. Paying attention. That wasn't an easy, you only mentioned that once. So I'm impressed, Stephen, paying attention. Stephen, in that same text box, send me your shipping address so we can get that over to Stackpole and get a book shipped out to you. I've got your name. I've got your email. I just need your shipping address, and we'll get that done and shipped out to you. So congrats, and thanks for playing. Henry, hey, thanks so much. I appreciate you being on with us tonight and sharing your knowledge. I don't even think we broke the surface, no pun intended, of your knowledge bank. But sure appreciate what you're able to share with us in the short time we had with you.
Oh, it was a treat to be here. So thanks so much. You know, I'm honored to be on here. It's always cool to talk about fishing and bugs with like-minded people. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. Hopefully you've all found the podcast archive on our website. If you haven't, just look for the link on the top line of our menu. In that archive, you'll find all of our past shows. I think over 425 shows now, which you can search by keyword or keyword phrase like trout, tarpon, you know, mayflies, whatever. And I'm sure you'll be pleasantly surprised at what you find out there in our archive. Our next broadcast will be on September 24th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. And on that show, I'll interview Aaron Jasper. Aaron's been on our show multiple times, by the way. So you can search him in the archive and see what past shows he's been on with us. This coming show is going to be Fly Fishing is More Than Euro Nymphing. Euro nymphing may dominate the rivers, but it's only part of the story. Join Aaron as he reveals why being a versatile angler makes fly fishing more rewarding and more productive. From lessons learned over 44 years on the water to the balance between numbers and trophy fish to his top five insights from 2025, Aaron's going to share his wisdom that will help you catch more fish and deepen your love of the sport. Be sure to add this upcoming show to your calendar by just clicking that Add the Calendar button below his picture on our homepage, and then you'll be reminded and be there for the live show. We'd like to thank Fly Fishers International, Trout Unlimited, Bonefish and Tarpon Trust, Olympic Peninsula Skagit Tactics, and the Ugly Bug Fly Shop, and also Watermaster for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future live broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.